Welcome back to Dr. Brass Tacks. Good morning.
Good morning, Peter.
Good morning. Hey, morning, sir. How are you doing?
I'm pretty good. I hope you are enjoying your stay to the fullest.
I am indeed, sir. I am. Working hard.
I'm glad to hear. Working and enjoying at the same time. That's good.
Good.
Now, Peter, I want to talk about your pet peeve politics this morning. You there?
I am here. I'm listening carefully, sir. Go ahead.
Good, good, good. Now, I'm sending out the SOS for you, Peter Wickham, to come back to this country as soon as possible to rescue Verla the Pizza. Peter, could you imagine Dennis Law saying that he will be vying for the vice president and some other position, I don't remember the position, within the Democrat Labour Party in their upcoming conference?
Mm-hmm.
He also said that he would be running even if he had to run as an independent, Peter. I want to hear your response to that before I go further. I know you love politics. That's why I come up with those topics.
No, I mean, I honestly don't know that there's anything I can do for Verla. My support for her is well known and has been advertised on this program and other places. But I think it's also well known that a lot of the advice, and I have given Verla as much advice as I can in the public domain. I haven't spoken to her privately and said anything I haven't said on the radio. But my ideas regarding what DLP could do to put itself back into office have been flatly rejected. One of them is that I think they should keep as far as possible from Dennis Law. I can't imagine why they would want to run him as a candidate, far less make him a vice president. But ultimately, the organization has the right to determine on the inside who they feel that they should associate with. And I still ask the question, why is it that you have people like Ryan Waters out there? You have people like Simon out there. And all of these people are out there, but yet still knocking on the door and they can't get in. And Dennis Law could be nominated as a candidate. And then this other thing, I heard him yesterday on the program, and he's saying that he can't comment any further on whether he has been approved as a candidate. What was this big top secret thing? If you're choosing candidates, why as a party, if you're choosing candidates, you can't tell the public? I hear this one get nominated. I hear the next one get nominated. But yet still, we can have no official position saying the party has declared candidates. When this guy was nominated to run against the Bishop Atherley, the nomination was held in the public domain. He won the nomination and the party celebrated his triumphant victory. What's the secret? You know, if you are happy about nominating a candidate, why should you be keeping it secret? And that's what I'm not understanding.
But you know, Peter, my whole concern about the entire matter is, when you look within the Democrat Labour Party and you see these same personalities coming again, even with the leader, the present vice president, president of the Democrat Labour Party, Verla Pizza. She was one who was in the old team that the people of this country reject. And that's my problem when you get these same people coming back, even as a leader. And I said to David Ellis, I think it was David I spoke to, that I believe they should look within the party at the younger and more mature persons as far as politics is concerned. And I nominate one of those individuals to lead the party. And no, as I said to him, you can't expect they would lead the party into a victory in the next coming election. But at least they will have the chance to prepare themselves as a future leader of the party. And that's why you even have a serious problem with Verla even coming to lead the party, Peter. What do you think? What's your take?
I understand where you're coming from. The challenge is that it has not been easy in the sense that the only person that was nominated last time was her. And the other nominations I heard from... she was selected, right, because nobody else was nominated. I was hearing about Reverend Hewitt. His name was knocking around. But there were no other real names that were knocking around in the fray. So while I agree with you that the ideal would be to choose a person who was not tainted by that whole mess that was 2018, the point is also that you have to choose essentially who is available to you at that point in time. So you know, they were going on the basis of what's available. If this time around they have a choice between two, which is the George Pilgrim and Verlie de Pisa, what do you think they should do?
As I said, Peter, '92 won't really come up to my marks.
Nobody else ain't come forward.
Well, that's a no-no for me as far as I'm concerned, because I would have to sprain my brain, to be honest with you, to recommend either one of the two to you. So as far as that concerned, I just can't give you an answer to that particular question.
No, I thought about it, and I wondered really, and like you, I feel that the idea would be to get someone coming from outside. The problem is that if there's nobody who is interested, then what are they supposed to do? I mean, there were some young Democrats that were knocking around, like the same Simon Allen, the Harry Husbands. You know, there were youngsters that I wondered why those youngsters are not more actively involved in the DLP's politics. But the point is that I guess you can't force them on the DLP. And if they haven't put their name forward as a candidate, as an option for president, then what are they supposed to do? But, yeah.
That's why we don't know exactly how to answer that question. Now, before going to my another point, I also want you to ask Straker's Tennis 3 if he's throwing his hat in the ring as well. So when
but he's he in our general counsel. I thought he was general counsel. Is he our general counsel?
I'm not too sure.
Sure he's our general counsel. All right, now, let me not defend you, my character. I believe he's serving some role, but I don't know that he's an option for president. I don't think so.
The way he portrayed himself in front of the party, I thought normally he would be in some top.
I thought he's one of the foot soldiers that is on the ground, one of the field marshals in various constituencies. I don't know that he is presidential, but I believe that he is general counsel. So I don't know.
Let me go on my now.
When is the day? Is the end of September?
I'm not too sure. No, I'm not too sure.
I see Dennis mumbling. Is it 15th? Is that Dennis? Yeah, the 15th. Yeah. So I'm trying to read Dennis's lips. And let's keep saying the 15th. I don't know these things. I messaged my friend George, and he wouldn't give me any information on what's going on. So
he's keeping everything tight, man. Yeah. Now, let me go to my point. My next point. Sorry. Now, I heard Glenn Murray a couple of days ago speaking to, I think it was Dennis Johnson, and his concern about the present members of Parliament is, and I hope I'm not quoting him wrong, but he is concerned that he is not hearing the voices like what he was hearing during the last election on these same members of Parliament now when they was on the political platform. And even though I could agree in a way with what he was saying, Peter, I don't think it was a fair assessment of the certain members of Parliament at the present moment. Because the way Parliament is constructed at the present moment, Peter, those voices in Parliament do not have the I don't say competition, but they don't have the persons so that you can see their debating skills in Parliament. Not one of those members, certain members of Parliament at the moment that I can remember had or has the opportunity right now to show their real skills as debaters in Parliament. And it's simply because there are no opposition in Parliament apart from just Reverend Attlee. And more often than not, he may even agree with some of the proposals from the government, even though sometimes he disagrees, his voice is concerned about certain things. But more often than not, he will support government measures. So they don't got the opportunity to really debate. And it's very again, it's not like cut and thrust debate in Parliament. You have people like Sandra Husbands, Edmund Hinkson, Marsha Callan. These are people, Peter, that I know can debate to the highest level. And I'm not even mentioning Kerry Summers Toppin, Ronald Toppin, sorry, or even the other, so to speak, the more older members of Parliament that we had previously. But those younger members of Parliament, they don't have the opportunity so that we can see the skills, the debating skills. So I think it was a very unfair assessment from Glenn. What do you think?
No, I want to suggest, I want to agree with you, but I want to say something a little different. I think our expectations are higher, and I think that we have expectations that Parliament is not something that it once was. When I was growing up, and I mean, Parliament was what you couldn't, to start with, you couldn't log in online. You had to go and be searched and enter the building and be classified as a stranger. These days, you can listen to Parliament at your desktop. So we are hearing Parliament a lot more than we were before, because there was no broadcast in those days, things of that nature. Right. So that's something that we need to be clear about. The other point is that the times have changed. And I think that as a result, people communicate far differently. Errol Barrow and Tom Adams facing off in Parliament, there will never be a day like that again. There will never be a debate like the one in which Erskine Sandiford defended his stewardship when the vote was brought against him. There will never be a debate like that again. Parliamentarians these days have opportunities to communicate. And you have some parliamentarians that communicate very effectively using social media. If you look at Sandhya Bradshaw's communication profile using social media, if you look at the Minister of Finance who communicates also very effectively. Indeed, I would say both ministers of finance, because both Strachan and Marsha Cattell also both use social media effectively. During the COVID period, every morning, Ryan Strachan would send out a song to his WhatsApp followers, and he would communicate with them in that way. To the point I'm trying to make is that there are so many different mechanisms to communicate that are available. It's entirely possible that someone would say, you know, Marsha Cattell's personal style of communicating via WhatsApp and Facebook is preferred to the fact that she can go into Parliament and face off against somebody who is not there in this case, because there's nobody in opposition to face off against. So I don't know if you get my point. I think that our expectations are different. When people say to me, but you know, your grandfather wrote so much better than you, your uncle wrote so much better than you, why don't disagree? They probably did. The difference is that my grandfather would write an article and essentially the newspaper would probably be 10 pages, if so many, and his article would be the one and only, or there would be one other article in the newspaper. There was not the option that he has. I can write something on Facebook almost every day and get information out there. So the care that he took in writing that one article that he wrote in the whole week is different to the care that I would take in writing an article that I would probably write in 3 hours, because I got something else to do a few hours later. So I think that that's part of the problem. Our expectations of parliamentarians are different, because the communicative ability, the Winston Churchills of contemporary politics, are communicating with people in other ways. And I think that we could agree in the United Kingdom is the same thing. You don't hear anybody speaking in the way that Winston Churchill spoke, because communication is different. Even Barack Obama was a very effective communicator, but again, very different to the Winston Churchills of this world. So I do feel that things have changed. But I'm agreeing with you that I think it's much ado about nothing, quite frankly. Yes, Pfizer?
Because, Peter, to be honest with you, Sandra Husband's skills, I mean, if she had a face off in Parliament, Peter, it would be most outstanding debate you could ever want to hear.
Mm-hmm.
And I close by saying this just on the side, something you observe, this observation, so to speak. I have noticed something happening that I know you would welcome. One of the banks now, the well-known banks in this country, has now closed off, over-the-counter transactions that the bank down St. James. You can check it out. No more over the counter transactions. I thank you, Peter.
All right, sir. Thanks a lot for calling. Like you said, I would like that. Well, that's the way it's going. That's the way it's going globally. Dr. Brastax, good morning.
Yes, good morning, Peter. How are you doing, sir?
Morning, sir. How are you doing?
Yeah, I'm all right, thanks. We're all here.
Hey, right. Hey, Roll. How is it?
Everything is observing, you know, carrying out analysis, mm-hmm. as they often mm-hmm. do. But I want to clear the air on something that was muted and set straight. You would have heard the talk about jurisdiction and with Mr. Donovan Innes, how the Americans, whatever, and what went on and wasn't right from what was right, et cetera. You remember hearing that?
I did, yes.
Good. The point I want to highlight here today is when Mr. Innes was arraigned in court, the former Attorney General, Mr. Adrian Baffitt, was up there who is a former attorney general and also a lawyer who would know about jurisdiction and that sort of situation. You know all the rhetoric and jargon that you're hearing about when it wasn't represented from Barbados and all that foolishness. You know that no one, Mr. Baffa hasn't come out and he hasn't said anything as regarding the whole talk that you're hearing about jurisdiction and if the Americans acted right and all that. You know you're here, Mr. Baffa can't say a word. But you know he went up there.
But it wasn't a jurisdictional issue, Rob?
No, but you're hearing a foolish talk going on about what happened.
No. Rob, the talk you're hearing basically is that I believe it was a police commissioner or somebody in the police force said that they're not investigating him because he hasn't done anything wrong in Barbados. And I think that we generally agree that he's not charged in Barbados for anything because he hasn't broken any laws in Barbados.
I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about a caller making it and running a lot of rhetoric about what Barbados authority should do and what as compare America and Barbados. A caller is making that call all the time and misleading the public.
Raul, that you're confusing, or the caller may very well be confusing issues in the sense that they're confusing an unwillingness on the part of the authorities in Barbados to move on a matter as being a jurisdiction. And to me, there's no issue of jurisdiction, so there's nothing for the former AG to comment on.
But the point I'm making is that if a former attorney general was alongside him and a lawyer, with the lack of advice, that's the point I'm trying to establish. You see what I'm trying to say?
Okay.
Where's the lack of advice? And my second point. My second point, I am still concerned about the recycling situation in Barbados as it stands. I am still seeing cars going up to the landfill. The next thing with the spontaneous combustion, you're going to have another friend. Those people are going to be at the peril in Archall again. What is happening with the recycling? Why the recycling cannot come on board and discuss? What's happening with this, the other plant that you were hearing about? The that plant that was to be... Cahill, what all that talk? What's happening? Barbados is still in the dark as regarding going forward, as concerned with recycling garbage, and it's still an issue. What's happening with bees up there? The guy has a tread up there to tread up a whole set of garbage and whatever. Why isn't that into operation? Those are the sort of things that we want to hear about too, you know?
All right. So are we going to have to, well, I don't know, maybe Dennis has some level of influence in the organization. So maybe Dennis can use his influence to get us a Sunday brass tacks to look at the issue of recycling. I know that some progress has been made. There was talk of how we can identify a shredder for the tires. And I believe that project is advanced in some way. The challenge, of course, is always that, you know, these things take money and you don't.
But the shredder just
y'all just stuck at $33 million and spend on buses. So
the shredder at bees can shred anything, Mr. Wickham. The shredder at bees.
I don't know that the bees shredder is for that. I thought the bees shredder.
I am saying to you authoritatively that I can shred anything. I've been a bees city shredder. So don't let anybody come and fool you that it's doing for they're going to bring a special shredder for tires. That shredder can shred anything. What have you. So there's some underlying issue that needs to come to the fore. As regarding.
Very nice.
I regard you.
All right, sir. Thank you very much. Take care. Someone is advising me. Sorry, Dennis is telling me that apparently the 15th is the state opening of Parliament. So the Democratic Labour Party's conference will probably be after the state opening of Parliament, assuming that nobody in the Democratic Labour Party crosses the floor and ends up in the Senate. The presumption is that they'll be ready for the state opening coming on to the end. They're ready for the DLP's annual conference at the end of this month. And I think they were anxious to see who will emerge victorious in terms of the presidency and then certainly what the executive looks like if my good friend Dennis Law ends up as vice president or one of the vice presidents of the Democratic Labour Party, if he's able to knock out my other good friend, Irene Sandefur-Garner, current vice president of the party, along with Simon, I believe he's also a vice president. So it should be interesting. Down to brass tacks, good morning. Good morning and welcome. You're on the air, 4341790. Right, somebody's telling me that the reason that the young persons can't get in is because the branches are run by the old guard. So preference is in favor of the old guard And that's the reason why you're hearing so many old guard within DLP being rumored to run again. Good morning and welcome. You're on the air.
Yeah, how are you doing?
Good, I'm good, sir. How are you doing? Oh, this is Stas, man. How is it?
Yes, hi.
Good.
I know about two instances where one can describe as a minority government, right? The first one is as a racial minority, like, for instance, years ago in South Africa, or you could even say in Barbados in the plantocracy days. And the second instance is at the first past the poll system, whereby the government wins the most seats, but a lesser total of votes overall. I think it's quite weird someone is saying that in Barbados we have a minority government. I don't really get it. You don't want a more majority government than the one that we currently have in the country. Now, Outer, I have not gotten my figures from the Electoral and Boundaries Commission, but I see some in the papers that I saw there. So they might not be quite exact, but I guess it's a ballpark figure. There you had about over 153,000 votes, right, that were cast. The Bees received 112,000, 73.3%. The Zees received about 33,000, 21.8%. And the others, independents and the other French parties, they received over 7,383. 4.8%, bringing the overall thing to 99.9%. Mm-hmm. The Bees won all the 30 seats, where they lose one single box, JSC2 in St. John, by 205 to 239 votes, a mere 34 votes, right? 81 of the 134 candidates lose their deposits, including 8 from the DLP, because it was unable to garner more than 6% of the vote cast. So it's really shocking to hear anybody mentioning that Barbados has a minority government. You know, this is one of the biggest jokes that I've heard. But also, I like to look at, like, even say, for instance, this because the last time when I told you that I had something, you always going to talk about cabinet reshuffle. Now, Miss Motley, if you look at Miss Motley over the years that she'd been running for politics, she competed in 7 elections. Well, she lost the first one by a mere 167 votes, right? But for the rest of the years, she increased her vote. Not almost every election, she increased her awards.
Except 2008.
Hmm?
Except 2008.
Well, she didn't increase it over the current year, but she got a good, you know.
She got a good year.
Because she got 3,320. Right? Mm-hmm. And she won by 1,655 votes. So, but if you look at it, now the first time she ran 1991, she would have received 1,580 votes, lose by 167. Now this last one here, she won by 4,553 votes, and won by 3,883 votes, 87.1% of the votes cast. I mean, you know, so when people are trying to flag about Barbados having a minority government, I mean, this is the farthest thing from the truth. There's no evidence at all to support that. So I would like people to just simply dismiss that out of hand.
You heard that, Statsman? I never heard that. Where you heard that?
Well, someone mentioned it to me. I mean, I said, well, this thing doesn't even make sense repeating. He didn't want to discuss it with me, so I said, look, I will call on the program.
No, it's not.
Hmm?
couple of things, Sassman. The first point is it's not a minority government. Indeed, there's no minority in terms of seats. There's also no minority in terms of votes. And I will go farther and say that in terms of the Barbados Labour Party was able to achieve something in 2018 that very few political parties are able to do. So, for example, the Barbados Labour Party would have received 112,000 votes.
Yes.
Which is 73% of the votes cast. But the more important point for me is that the Barbados Labour Party, in terms of the persons registered, the persons registered in Barbados is 122,000.
Mm-hmm.
The persons registered to vote, precisely.
Mm-hmm.
The Barbados Labour Party is up to something like 48% of those persons, which is... It's interesting because it's almost half. And normally what happens is that political parties will gain a majority of votes cast for political parties. But it's seldom that they actually gain a majority of votes cast overall in terms of the number of people who are registered to vote over votes cast. And I think that that's a significant achievement. So the idea that they're a minority is something that cannot be entertained. What I do want to hear you on, though, is this whole question of power. Because there is a belief that because Prime Minister Motley has all the seats, she has powers that Fernando Stewart does not have. I want for you to tell me if you know of any power that the Prime Minister retains by having all 30 seats that Fernando Stewart did not have by just having a majority of one, other than the obvious, which is to change the constitution.
Right.
Not in terms of the activities. Right.
Not that I know of.
So this is what I think is confusing a lot of people, because they have this presumption that prime ministerial power is given out based on the percentage of the seats that you have in parliament, when the reality of the situation is that all you need is one. If you look at Ralph Gonzalez, for example, Ralph Gonzalez has had a majority of one for 10 years. When you hear him speak, you would never guess that he had the same majority that Fernando Stewart had. He's had cabinet reshuffle, all kind of thing, and he has the same majority that Fernando Stewart had. But yet still, the belief that he is all-powerful is something that comes from the fact that, you know, it is the way in which the individual conducts himself. So that's my take.
Those are things that should be tried to flag. I can remember when Mr. Arthur, I think one of his cabinet members actually said it in St. Patrick's Great Church. Now, when she said that the government want to get all the seats, then people start flagging it, saying, you remember the time thing he was also talking about Republic, Karen Barbados to become a republic. And people don't get mixed up as well there. But, man, when you're a republic, man, you can't vote no more. You got all the seats, you got all the power, you know? So they get it confused with the whole idea. So, but no. She doesn't have any more power or less power than any other prime minister, right? Mm-hmm. Winning all the seats doesn't mean you have any more power, right? She's the prime minister. Now, look at the same guy. In Grenada, he won clear. He won by all the seats, so two or three times or something like this.
That's right, yeah. Three times.
Yeah, that didn't think stupid. But actually, people will say to you, Mr. John King made that. Well, I don't think he tried to make it at this point, but he spoke at some branch meeting. And he said, look, these things are really difficult now, because this is the first time ever that where somebody have all the seats, so you know you got to share around. You can't, because like normally when you got about, say, 20... 26, 4, or whatever like that, you might not want to support the opposition candidates, you know? But if you got all 30 belongs to the said party, so you have to basically share around, make sure everybody get a piece of the cake. So it's not necessarily a bad thing. And I would like to say this too, because I hear one or two people saying you got to vote to get a strong opposition and all this lot of things. You might end up, you don't vote for oppositions, you just vote for a government. So when you go there to the polls, you look for the best candidate and also the best party to run the country. That's how you should vote. You can't go all the way, vote to get an opposition. You might end up throwing away the government. you vote for you should be voting for your government, right? For a government that you want, and based on their track record, based on their track record, because now I hear one or two people flagging this idea about how that. Well, I'm not coming down on no side, but I'm dealing with reality. Yesterday, Australia just went into official recession in 30 years. First, well, basically it's 29, but it's just saying rounding off if I got 30. Australia went into recession 30 years, all due to COVID. Do people need to understand this whole world is in topsy-turvy because of COVID? So it's not necessarily Barbados per se, where people are. You're trying to send home people, you're trying to shut down this, you're trying to shut down that. You know, this the world have never seen this yet.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not a simple matter of, and as I said, this government had done well because I remember, for instance, like the Indian government, Indian Prime Minister, when he went to his lockdown, he said, as of midnight tonight, there's a lockdown. You know, tons and tons of people got trapped on the road walking to come back home. But the Prime Minister in Barbados had done that. And I was saying from day one, Barbados have the best COVID policy put in place. The best. Now, the cases now we're getting now is the cases are imported. And all you have to do, the one or two cases, you put the people in isolation, and you run your country because you cannot shut down the country indefinitely. Because we don't have a date for when COVID will close. You know?
Right. Understood and agreed. We don't know. Precisely, we don't know when it's going to end. Yeah.
You don't know when it's going to end. So you can't just, because you got two things that you're dealing with, the economic and the economic and the health. So I think I heard one of the thing for the children, well, the children charities. They said they gave a projection that 70,000 children in Africa will die probably this year due to acute starvation because of the shutdown of the same COVID. So it's two things you're balancing at the same. So Barbados, one or two people are saying, my Barbados is shut down. You should shut down. The Barbados dollar can't spend it inside Barbados. So it's going to get medicine, drug, everything that you need. So you still got to come. You know, people got to learn to understand what's happening in the country. You know?
Mm-hmm.
So they're handling things in the best way possible.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
So, Asman, it's always good to hear from you. Let's make way for a couple other people to call. It's good chatting, and I wish you all the best. I don't know if you're going to the state open in a parliament, so if I might see you on television, finally get to see who exactly you are. A lot of us wonder. We'll take a break and come right back. Welcome back to Down to Brass Tacks, 434-1790. Someone is suggesting that if the opposition parties in the next election will be fighting for 45% of the electorate, ensuring victory for the Barbados Labour Party. The assumption that the country is almost evenly divided and 5% are undecided, would that be a correct analysis? And I want to say to you, sir, that my assessment of the situation has always been that both political parties usually have around 40% of votes, and that the remainder of them is votes that float or move in one way or the other. The last election, however, demonstrated that theory had been blown out of the water. And the reality is that the core of the Democratic Labour Party that would remain faithful was around 33%. I'm still inclined to think that it may be as high as 40, and that maybe those 7% or so may very well have been Dems that just chose not to go out to vote. But it's going to be interesting. One thing I would agree with you, however, is that the more alternative parties that emerge, the more damage it will do to the Democratic Labour Party. And I argued that in the last election, when many analysts were suggesting that the third parties or fourth and fifth parties were a reflection of the fact that the Barbados Labour Party was fragmented. The theory, as I understand it, certainly based on my experience, has been that whenever you have multiple political parties competing, they are essentially fighting among themselves for space that's not occupied by one central force. And the central force in the last election, was clear to me, was the Barbados Labour Party. So I always knew that they would damage the Democratic Labour Party. And I would argue that even now, when you are hearing the PDP You're hearing the other political party solutions, Barbados. All of these are essentially fighting for a space that's occupied by the Democratic Labour Party. And the Democratic Labour Party has been attacking the Barbados Labour Party and should presumably turn some of its energies towards these other parties that are essentially cannibalizing what is a very small vote that the Democratic Labour Party can lay claim to. So that would be my sense of it. So I think you're on pretty solid ground. Good afternoon, good morning, and welcome. Good morning and welcome. 434-1790, I guess you need to turn your radio down. We say good morning and welcome. You're on the air.
Yeah, morning.
Morning.
Can you hear me now? Okay.
I'm hearing you perfectly, sir.
Right. I wanted to address a matter that I've heard coming from the leader of the Barbados Workers Union and also from your first caller this morning. I'm not normally given to calling these programs, but I think this matter is of enough importance that it really ought to be addressed head on, and that this myth be not allowed to live too long, because lies once told or misinformation given can tend to take on lives of their own. And it applies to what is said by your first caller about the supermarkets doing so well, and what the leader of the trade union, two leaders of the trade union, seem to be coming to the conclusion that this is an act of wickedness, because they did so well during the COVID-19 period, and now they want to just get rid of staff, really, you know, now that things have cooled down. And this is very troubling, because it can lead persons to vilify supermarkets and persons and business persons. Now, I'm a business person. I employ people. And I believe that in fairness. And I am very disappointed that so-called intelligent persons, and that's why I say so-called, is that when you hear persons with these narratives, it really causes you to question how really informed they are, or how intelligent they are, or if they're being just plain wicked. Because the fact that supermarkets had long lines of people all around the supermarket, I don't know how they can come to the conclusion that they just did a lot of money because that was the case. That is troubling. Here, this comes from leaders, because supermarkets may have had long lines, but the long lines does not necessarily translate into increased revenue or even maintenance of comparable revenue from prior years. Because if you look and see what happened during the COVID-19 experience, and it also happened in my instance, I concentrated on buying the basic food stuff, stocking up on basic things, stocking up on perishables, because one never knew where this was going, how long it would go, and how deep it would cut. So many of the higher priced items, which is in the supermarkets, which would obviously carry the higher markets, I shied away from that. And I concentrated myself on those, and there's some persons who I help, and I concentrated on the basic things. And those basic things, that basic basket of items, contains, generally speaking, lower margin items. But what these persons have totally ignored is that the impact of not having in the island a significant number of tourists. And if you look across on the West Coast, let's say Massey, for instance, because Massey's name was called. Massey have the Big Beast Market, which is in Worthing. They have the Sunset Crest Market, which is in Holtown. And both of those supermarkets have a large proportion of their sales coming from visitors who are staying at all-inclusive, who are staying at timeshare resorts, like Divi and so on, and who do a lot of shopping for their own selves. When these persons shop, they shop and cater to a taste which they have acquired and which tend to be towards the high-priced items. And supermarkets cater to them by making sure they have these items which carry the higher margins in stock. Then suddenly all of those patrons disappeared. Then, and you had replacing them persons just concentrated on the standard basket of items, which carry very low margins. You know, you hear the expression before, stock them high and sell it cheap. And sometimes that would include even loss leaders, things that are sold below cost in order to attract volume. So it is disparaging, and it is ignorant. It is sad and troubling that these leaders could be trying to put a narrative which would cause persons to believe that these persons who have significant skin in the game, the unions don't have any skin in the game. They are simply interested in speaking a narrative that attracts listeners and make persons see that they're looking after the poor black man. And it is nonsense, and it is sad. I am a poor person, probably better off than the average poor person, but I can help others. And I'm also a business person who have suffered during this period as well. But I understand that my costs went up as much as everybody else's did, and yet, and my revenue went down. So the supermarket had longer lines, and all those lines which you saw said in the supermarket, when you check with the supermarket, they would have said you the volume of people that patronized their place during the time was less. Because all those people could easily have held it, hold into the supermarket. But because of having to do social distances, then they were outside for extended hours. And if you pass 2 hours, if you pass there at one time, and 2 hours later you pass and the line is just as long, then the line may only have had 10 more people onto it.
Mm-hmm.
But because of the length of time it takes for persons to go in and come out, then you're seeing the line the same time. Because persons are afraid and people are not taking any risk. But yet they have to employ persons now to check the temperature of people, to patch it, and then they did the curbside shopping, which was a disaster. I know that myself because I went and shopped at the supermarket for a lady who had ordered something on the internet. And the supermarket was simply unable. I went to the supermarket at one time and saw persons up and down, eyes looking for things and packing baskets, staff. And I had to say, this doesn't make sense. How could you have 8 members of staff up and down a supermarket packing baskets to shop for items that come in on the computer? Then, it is too labor intensive. So the supermarkets absorb significant costs as a result of having to care for these special needs and as a result of having to put up fresh barricades to protect their own staff. A whole myriad of things that the union, and I don't know, could the leadership be this ignorant or... It is wrong. It is not fair. And we must be careful that we don't go down and try to create an unjust society by making the populace feel that supermarkets are acting wickedly. That's all I wanted to say. It is important
that the matter be addressed. Yeah.